Hello and welcome to this as yet untitled Royal Meteorological Society podcast. It's our first one. I guess we should introduce ourselves. I'm Richard Parsons. I'm the digital producer here at the Royal Meteorological Society.
Hi, I'm Professor Liz Bentley and I'm chief executive at the Royal Meteorological Society. And I guess my first question, Richard, is why are we doing podcasts?
Well, I'm a big fan. You've known that since I got here. I've been talking about them and the ones I've done in the past. And I think it's a really good format. I think it's a perfect way for us to engage with our audience and sort of extend the conversation away from our online platforms, I guess, our website and our social media. Those things are all very valuable and we're very active on them. But I think this is a good way of bringing more people in to get their voices heard, I guess.
So this is the first one, and we'll be interviewing people from across the Met community in different walks of life, whether they're working in research in meteorology or working as a profession in meteorology, so maybe forecasting or consulting.
Yeah, some high-profile figures, hopefully. Get some meteorological stars in.
And a range of topics. So, you know, we could be talking about, you know, the pure science of meteorology, whether that's weather or climate, or actually more of the applications or communication of our science, which is very much the feature of this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess before we get into that, maybe you should, there may be people listening who don't really know what the society does.
Yeah, so. Okay. So, well, the Royal Met Society, gosh, we've been around a long time. We were founded in 1850. And we're here really to support the community. I would often say we're facilitators. So we put on activities and events that really support the whole Met community and also those who have a general interest in meteorology. So they may not work in meteorology. It's all about promoting the understanding and application of meteorology for the benefit of everybody. That's our mission, I guess, in this. So we do lots of things. So we have professional accreditation in meteorology. So if you worked in meteorology, you could work to become a chartered meteorologist, for example. We have 7 international journals. So if you're a scientist, you can publish your science in any of these journals and they have international reach. We do lots of education and outreach activities, very much part of our charitable aims of the society. And we put on lots of events. So typically, over the course of a year, we might put on 75 events. That could be national conferences, and we run 3 of those a year. We also have local centre meetings, so meetings that take place regionally around the country.
How many of those are there?
So there's 9 of those that are actively putting on meetings during the year. We have special interest groups as well, so focusing on particular areas of meteorology. So if you're interested in the history of meteorology, we have a group that looks after that. If you're interested in climate science, there's a special interest group for that. We have one called WAM, which is Weather, Art and Music. So it's about reaching new audiences of people through the art and music communities to reach out to them about meteorology, weather and climate. And we have a series of national meetings. Some of them are at the weekend for our more amateur meteorologists, so those who work in other fields but want to come along to our meetings at the weekends, and then our Wednesday meetings. And we had one of those, we're back into our kind of season again now in September. We had our first one of those last week called Message Impossible. And you were at that, Richard. So What did you find about that meeting?
Well, I had my head down for most of it, trying to broadcast it on Facebook Live for the first time, which went reasonably well. A few hiccups, but it was, I think we got there in the end. It was a really interesting meeting. I was quite interested in the stuff that Ross from the Met office had to say. But a lot of it went a little bit over my head, I have to say, but I'm not a trained meteorologist, but it was all very, very interesting. And one of the things that we did after that was we sat down with Andrew, who's the meeting organizer, who works at Reading University, lecturer at Reading, and Rebecca, who is from the American National Center for Atmospheric Research.
Well done, NCAR.
NCAR, yes. we had a very interesting half an hour conversation with them, and that's what follows. So we're here at the Meteorology Department at Reading University and have Liz Bentley, who's Chief Executive of the Royal Meteorological Society. Myself, I'm Richard, I'm the digital guy at the Royal Meteorological Society. And we have Andrew Charlton Perez from the University of Reading. He's an Associate Professor of Meteorology and the Deputy School Director of Teaching and Learning at the University. And we have Rebecca Morse, who's a Senior Scientist and Deputy Director in the Mesoscale and Microscale Meteorology Laboratory at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. So welcome, guys.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. It's the day after our Message Impossible meeting, which we had at Imperial College in London. which is a great success. So basically the day was to discuss about issues around communicating meteorology and weather science to the wider population, I guess. So Liz, if you want to talk us through your thoughts on the meeting.
So first of all, just want to thank you both for your involvement yesterday, and particularly Andrew for kind of organising the whole event and getting a fantastic range of speakers along to that event. It was a really good afternoon, really interesting talks. It was really there to stimulate lots of discussion. So I think the kind of things I want to kind of talk about over the next 10 minutes or so really are to kind of pull out some of those points that we started to kind of tease out during the meeting, and just to kind of stimulate further discussion after this podcast, really. One of the first things that came out to me during the afternoon's meeting was really thinking about the kind of challenges that we have in providing effective communication of weather information. So I don't know if you had any thoughts on that. Can I start with Rebecca?
Sure. There are lots of challenges in providing effective communication of weather information. One is that there's a lot of diversity in what people think about the weather and how they interpret weather information, and that's one thing that came out in the meeting yesterday, that different people think different things when they get the same message. And so that means that you can't communicate to everyone in the same way because different people will think different things. Another thing that came out of the meeting yesterday was the importance of communicating about the impact that people will experience, not just the weather. That if you say the temperature is going to be a certain number of degrees, people have a harder time understanding that than if you say it's going to be a certain number of degrees, this will be very hot, you will need to drink water, stay in the shade, and those kinds of things. And that's also the case for extreme weather, such as flooding. So those are some of the challenges. Also, some challenges are that when you are talking about extreme weather where you want people to make protective decisions, people need to have the ability to make those decisions. So there was a discussion yesterday about some of the heat and cold related issues in the UK for health impacts, and that, for example, some people might not be able to afford to heat their own homes. And so if you just tell them to heat their homes, they can't do that. So how do you help them protect themselves? And then also for more extreme weather like wind was talked about yesterday, and floods and hurricanes and so on, people also need to be able to have the information in a timely manner to protect themselves, and then also know what to do and be able to do it.
Andrew, any thoughts?
Well, I really thought one of the interesting things was something you said, Rebecca, which was that the communication system is changing so much, and as researchers, we're almost always kind of behind where the public are and where organisations need to be in terms of communicating those messages. So if you know, we heard some things about studying Twitter data, for example, but it may be that in a couple of years, Twitter's not the same medium that it is now. It has a different audience. It may have a broader or narrower reach. And just staying ahead of that and being clear about what each of the different ways of communicating with people can do is a real challenge, I think. And it felt like to me that in the US, this is something that people have thought about a lot and have been working on a lot, but something we're only really beginning to start to touch the surface of now. And that was really one of the motivations for the meeting, is getting people who are interested in that problem together but have very different perspectives. And hopefully by bringing them together, you can create something that's greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and having been to the UK a few times in the last few years, I've seen how in the last few years interest in this area has really grown. Mm-hmm. And 5 or 10 years ago in the US, there was very little work. So that's really advanced a lot in the U.S., and so I think that you guys are on the right path. I also think with respect to what you said about the kind of changing information environment and how people are getting information, that's definitely true. And as meteorologists, we often think if only people would get their information the way we want them to, if only they would just listen to the forecasters and not their friends and so on, if only they would not go on Twitter when they could watch the TV or go on the Met Office website and see kind of the official message. We think those things, but in reality, people are doing these things because they're getting the information where it meets them in their everyday lives. And so I think rather than wishing people would do it a different way, we have to recognize they're going to do what they're going to do, and they're going to think of new things before we think of them. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to kind of, it's like being in a stream, you know, you have to kind of follow the flow where the communication is going, while also making sure to communicate well with people who aren't on Twitter, aren't on social media. Mm-hmm. Those people are still very important to communicate with, but to kind of recognize that people are rapidly evolving how they're communicating, especially young people today, They're very innovative, and what's going on now isn't going to be what's going on in 6 months, and that's just the way it is, and there's really good things about that, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be hugely exciting. I think that's one of some of the things we saw at the end of the meeting from, yes. from Ross Midlam at the Met Office, which is the incredible diversity of ways you can try to communicate with people. And I think he was very excited about the possibility that the different ideas he could have, both to communicate about, you know, the kind of background information about meteorology and then today's forecast and what that means, and making that forecast really relevant to people in a way that perhaps we haven't quite done as well in the past.
So there were a number of examples in the talks yesterday about the advances in information, both in kind of numerical weather prediction information, but the ways we can communicate that information as well. Was there anything in particular that stood out for you from any of the talks yesterday where you thought, wow, that's really exciting and new, and I'd like to kind of find out more about that?
Two things for me. One was the impacts work that Becky Hemingway talked about with the impacts modeling, and also that Angie Bone talked about with the health work. The ways that they were, for different kinds of problems, looking at the evidence of what really impacts people to learn what to communicate and how, and doing that in a really quantitative way. We often have some information about what the impacts of different weather are, but to have the really the details and the evidence and so on to help with the messaging, I thought that was really interesting. And then the work that Ross showed at the end about the different ways they're communicating. And now to know that on Snapchat you need to be kind of quirky and or Instagram, you know, that the different ways you communicate on different channels is important, and the audiences in different channels are looking for different kinds of things. And so you really have to be up on what the different channels are and how people are using them.
Anything stand up for you, Andrew?
Well, I think the thing that I've been intrigued by over the last few years is the naming of storms that the Met Office and Met Aaron have been doing, and just what reach that has had. And Becky presented some really nice evidence about the very broad reach potentially that naming initiative has had. But it also raised lots of kind of potential questions in my mind about what was then communicated to people when they were discussing those storms with the names. How did it change the kind of networks and the information flow around those events? It really kind of suggested lots of exciting projects to me, actually, that we might be able to do, hopefully with Becky and with others, around those topics. That feels to me like a really great opportunity for the UK in particular to think about, you know, a really big initiative which has had a lot of public interest that we can start to think about.
So there are a number of talks that touched on studies or research that's looked into the importance of communication and the improvements that we've seen in communication for helping decision makers. And I think both of you have been involved with those kind of studies. Is there anything that you'd like to highlight from yesterday's meeting that would be useful, a message to take away regarding how those studies have helped us to kind of understand, how we can effectively communicate, not just to the public, but to decision makers as well?
Yeah, for me, it's about the complexity of how people interpret information and make decisions. And small details can matter. For example, as the results that Marie showed, even small differences in the wording can matter. The work that Kelsey Mulder showed, which is work with Andrew, where small details in how you decide to graph information or even potentially have a key, that can matter for people. And so there's a lot of other research in this area that's shown similar things, even details that the communicators don't mean to have influence people's thinking can. And how also kind of the bigger picture of what you're communicating and why. So you have to think about the big picture of the message you want to get across, as well as the details of the specific things that people might interpret from that message and how to convey it.
And I think just kind of picking up on that, we're in a very exciting time in that we can produce these things very easily and very efficiently and get them out to people so quickly. And it's not the case that we have to convert it to something that can be sent on a telex or something. We can immediately produce a graph and get it to someone. But I think sometimes our thinking about what the graph actually conveys or what the language conveys is a little behind that, because it's so easy to do. And actually the studies that you need to do to test those things are quite hard. You need lots of people. You need to either get them in a room or you need to go out and talk to them online. And that can be, that's time consuming and expensive, and it needs to be planned carefully. And so I think, you know, I I've been involved in some of that research, so I would say that, but I'd certainly really encourage people to think about that a bit more and clever ways in which we can do that and interact with people more to test some of those things out.
And I think also, you know, related to what Andrew said, is there's many different ways to study any one of these questions. And in meteorology or any other kind of scientific research, you wouldn't just do one study and say you had the answer. So I think one thing that was so great about the meeting yesterday is we saw examples of different people studying interrelated things from different angles. And so by doing that, you can really build up a broader understanding than you can with any one study alone, using different methods, different disciplines, different kinds of messages, all those kinds of things.
And that came out as a clear message yesterday that, you know, people respond in different ways to different messages. And so we have to provide the, not just via different medium, but the language has to be different from time to time to provide a consistent message, but in different ways. And that was very clear yesterday. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we also picked up on, I guess, with the social skills, how people kind of react to these messages. So I'd just like to spend a few minutes really just thinking about the factors that influence how people interpret those messages, because that was something that was picked out yesterday, and just welcome your thoughts on that.
Well, I think there were lots of things there, right? So all the way from people's kind of worldview, you know, how they think about the world and their place in it, you know, down to their socioeconomic situation, their friends, their you know, everything about their lives basically can influence those things. And that can be hard because I think sometimes people are looking for a kind of magic bullet, you know, that this is the answer. You know, this will help you communicate to a large proportion of the population or this part of the population. And we kind of come from meteorology, I think, from this very broad mindset. So we're all used to having a TV weather forecaster who, you know, has a very difficult job trying to serve all of those different audiences, mm-hmm. And put a weather forecast in terms that everyone can take a bit away from. And so because of that mindset, it then makes this transition to, well, let's study for this particular group. From the health example, it might be people who are in fuel poverty, and that socioeconomic indicator might also be correlated with other things about how they get their weather forecasts or their trust in weather forecasts. And that's a really complex picture, really rich picture that really deserves a lot of study.
Yes.
Which a lot of people are doing, and you know, Angie and her team at Public Health England are fantastic at trying to do some of that and pull some of that out. Mm-hmm. But I think for decision makers and for government, that can sometimes be a little bit of a hard sell because it is so complex, mm-hmm. and it requires, you know, lots of different strategies and different techniques, mm-hmm. When we're sometimes looking for that broad, sort of slightly more old-fashioned approach, if I might say.
And yesterday we touched on the use of language and the importance of tailoring the language to the audience, but also visuals as well, and the impact that visuals can have. And I think that came out in a number of talks yesterday.
Right, and there's a lot of different visuals out there in today's world. I think one of the complexities with that is that people interpret them differently. I mean, Andrew and Kelsey have shown this in their own work, that there are some kinds of visuals that if you're a meteorologist or you have training and statistics or something else, you might be used to a certain kind of graphic and interpret it in a certain way. But other people won't interpret it that way. They're going to struggle with it. There's issue with maps. How can people orient themselves on a map? Can they understand the information? A lot of the information that scientists tend to produce can be pretty complex. And so unless you're familiar with it, it can be really hard to understand. And I think how people use information is also, as Andrew was talking about, really contextual. So we like to have kind of general rules about, say, if we want to communicate with people on Twitter, it'll be this way. If we want to communicate with older adults who are watching TV, it'll be this way. But really, a lot of it depends on the contextual issues about where are they getting their information, what are they doing that day, what other worries do they have in their mind, what kind of resources do they have, you know, are they taking care of their parents or their kids, or all those kinds of things, mm-hmm. you know, really matter for decision making. In the end, when people make the decisions, it's really all those things that come together when they decide what to do. In our studies, we've done some work with hurricane evacuation decision-making, which is has been big in the U.S. the last month or so. And there's a lot of complexities to how people are deciding what to do and how they're interpreting the information that make it really complicated to come up with general rules. So it's a question really of understanding the details of what's happening in specific situations, but then doing that in a way where you can build up a broader understanding that you can apply to other problems.
And it's kind of an exciting time because there are more, in some circumstances, there are more people on the ground, or there are more people on the ground who are at least aware of those complexities and aware of the weather information. So I know, for example, that the Met Office has this, you know, advisors, it's advising civil, for civil contingency around the country, and having those people kind of on the ground talking to first responders and, mm-hmm. and you know, acting as a conduit for some of that information is a fantastically positive thing. And we see that actually a lot with our graduates, where they, in the past, they might have gone to do jobs where they would be forecasters, providing this kind of broad forecast, as I talked about. And increasingly, they're employed by companies where they have a very specific role, which is to interpret the forecast in terms that the company can understand and use. And to me, that feels exactly where the field is going and where most of our people will be employed in the future. There's a really important role there for people to interact with the fantastic range of forecasts that we have available now. Things that we couldn't have imagined being able to do even 10 years ago that we can do now.
So a number of the talks yesterday homed in on some really exciting activities that are happening now and talking about possible things for the future. I just wondered if you could pick out a few highlights from yourself on the talks that we had yesterday about the kind of here and now and where things are going over the next few years.
Yeah, one thing is how with the rapid communication of information, as Andrew mentioned, the ability to really change information quickly and get it out there quickly is the capability now to really get feedback in real time about messaging and change it on the fly. So Ross gave some examples about how they're there 24/7. When something happens, they can produce a new message on Snapchat or Instagram or Twitter or whatever to kind of get it out there to people. And as people are, meteorologists are more connected with the users, they can hear if someone's not understanding something, either on Twitter or in real time, and really emphasize the importance of the message and the important aspects of the message. So I think that's, or produce new graphics that communicate the things in a different way because people are misunderstanding something. I think that's a real area for future potential. Also, I think Paul Knightley talked about the Internet of Things and big data, and there are all these trends going on in society and in the research community at large. And I think for the weather community to engage with that more in addressing these things, understanding how can we communicate with different people in different ways, how can we get new kinds of data in really quickly, how can we do this kind of more rapid kind of updating of information and kind of engage with the whole way society is going now as everything is evolving so rapidly in new information technology. I think that there's a lot of potential there, and we've only just started to think about how to do that.
And I think I picked up on that a little bit from something else Paul said, which was about the forecaster as a storyteller. So part of the difficulty sometimes in getting your message out is the world is flooded with information, as I think he said. And so you have to do something interesting and exciting to be noticed. And certainly as someone who teaches people to be meteorologists, that's something I think about a lot, and think about our curriculum is, you know, it can't just be focused around being a fantastic physical scientist, although of course that's hugely important to being a meteorologist. It's also about all of those kinds of other communication skills. Being able to tell a great story and back up your story with data is so important now, and it's we would be doing people a disservice if we didn't teach them how to do that or help them to develop their own skills in that area. So I was very excited about that. And I'm also slightly kind of in awe, but very excited about all the design work. So I love, you know, I have connections with designers here in Reading, my colleague Alison Black in typography, but I loved some of the things that Ross showed, getting people who really think in that creative visual way to, he showed some great examples, for example, of someone showing the Global Mean Temperature series as a book. Mm-hmm. Where the spine told the time series of the temperature, and other examples like that, which just were really outside of my own experience of thinking about things, but really had a wow factor and an excitement, which can generate new interest in these things.
And one of the things Paul also talked about was the complexity of communicating really local information to a broader population. So he showed an example of a local thunderstorm and what should be the weather icon that should represent that area. And of course, it depends on if you're right under the thunderstorm or next to it or further away. And one of the questions that came to him from the audience was about hyper local forecast apps, because now some people are getting you know, are able to put in their exact location and get a forecast for their location, mm-hmm. and they're getting used to this. And of course, you know, 20 or 30 minutes in advance, or sometimes an hour in advance, you can get that information accurately. But if you're looking out 3 days or 6 days, that information, there's a lot of uncertainty in the information at that local location. And so how do you kind of meet the people's desire to have information about where they are exactly and where they're going to be when? How does that connect with what is really predictable and what kind of information can we provide? And how do we kind of bridge that space between the predictability and what is predictable with the locally specific information that people want to know?
And I think the graphics nowadays look so realistic that, you know, as forecasters, we understand that, you know, if you see an area of rain over a certain place at a certain time, that there's, you know, there's clearly, you know, going to be a little bit of uncertainty there. But I think to the general public, it's like, oh, it's going to rain here at 2 o'clock. And, you know, they almost take it because it just looks so good.
And one of the interesting conversations I have with people all the time is actually that they're not so worried about the forecast being inaccurate in that kind of hyperlocal sense, but it's the change from day to day which bothers them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether there is something that could be thought about there in terms of how much changes on the 5-day timescale impact their confidence on a shorter timescale, where in fact we do have a lot more skill, and whether it might be a more optimal way of presenting information to have a little bit more of a smoothing on the data or on the time period or those kinds of things when we try to communicate on that slightly longer range.
Mm-hmm. And human forecasters do that. I mean, if the forecast changes too much, the human will sort of not change too quickly because they know the next model run might come out with something different, but the apps aren't using humans often. They're just automated algorithms. And so how do they do that? And we've done some work on communication of storm surge risk in the U.S. associated with landfalling hurricanes. And that's the most common way that people die related to a landfalling hurricane, in terms of direct deaths at least. But a lot of people still don't evacuate because of storm surge. They don't realize they're at high risk. But what people want to know is, how deep is the flooding going to be at their location? Mm-hmm. And that's impossible to predict 24 hours in advance often, which is, people need to be evacuating 2 or 3 days in advance. Mm-hmm. So we've been trying to figure out ways to, how do you communicate the potential for the risk? So if the storm surge affects your location, this is what it can look like. This is how it can look related to the buildings. This is how fast the water can come in, so they can get the picture of what it could look like, but also not convey that as so realistic that it is what is going to happen, and are disappointed if it doesn't happen to them, because it's probably going to happen somewhere, just not in their location. And so this kind of balance between the realism that we can convey now, and that is important for people to understand what can really happen, and that they like because it seems more like the real world, kind of intermixed with the uncertainty, is important.
And actually, one of the things we didn't talk about yesterday, but something I'm interested in is how we communicate forecasts on longer time ranges, where the forecast will only ever be about, you know, small shifts to the PDF of temperature or precipitation over quite broad areas, depending on the time scale that you think about. And actually, the real advances we've seen in seasonal prediction, for example, you know, open those forecasts up to lots of applications, not necessarily to the general public, but to lots of decision makers. And I think the communication problem there is an interesting and slightly different challenge, because the kind of information we're trying to communicate is different. And I'm certainly keen to think more about that. I know there are others who are as well.
Mm-hmm. And yesterday's meeting touched on how we communicate uncertainties in models, so looking at probabilistic forecasts. I think it was recognised that actually people want more information. They want the full picture, but not in an overcomplicated way. And, it, you know, clearly interesting topic, but there's some real challenges in there. And I'd just welcome your thoughts on that.
Right. I think that a number of people have found that when you ask someone if they want uncertainty information, they might say, oh, no, I don't want that. I want to know what's really going to happen. But people are using uncertainty information all the time. They just don't think of it that way. We have some research that I talked about yesterday, that, and others have done similar work, where if you give people a piece of information, they interpret uncertainty around it. They don't think the weather forecast means exactly what you say, because they have experience knowing that it's not perfect information. And there's some work with the work that Kelsey Mulder showed about the ash forecasting, that people drew a larger area around the place where it was forecasted to have ash, indicating that they, you know, they drew a larger area, drew a box on a larger area of where you shouldn't fly, that so they were inferring there might be ash, you know, further beyond the forecast. And so because of that, we can't just assume that whatever information we give, people are going to interpret as it is. And if we give them uncertainty information or probabilities, they're going to interpret that exactly as it is. So a lot of it, in my mind, is about the complexity of taking the uncertainty and the certainty people have in their own minds, and how does the information project onto that? So a lot of people do things like they'll look at different forecasts from different sources, and from those decide what they think is the best answer, or they might decide to wait for more information because it seems too uncertain right now or something like that. So I think with communicating uncertainty or confidence or different possible outcomes, those are some of the ways that it was talked about yesterday, is framing it. I think it's really about thinking about the uncertainty people are already dealing with, and then meeting them in that space with the kind of language that makes sense to them. If they're thinking about different scenarios, or they're thinking about likelihood of different possibilities, or whatever they're thinking about, communicate in that frame.
And the language is important, isn't it? Because I think as scientists, we use the word uncertainty and we kind of understand what that means. But to the general public, it can have a very different meaning. And that was touched on yesterday as well.
And Marie in her presentation talked about how that negative framing really draws people to the negativity.
Yeah.
So to say uncertainty is different than saying, you know, something else, that there's something about that negative framing that really draws people to that, as opposed to saying something like different scenarios or something like that.
And I think when the interesting, when I talk about this with my colleagues, I think there's often a sense in which if we want to communicate uncertainty, then the public have to be able to understand precisely what we mean by that uncertainty, that they have to be able to define, almost in the way that we would define it, exactly what that number means. And of course, in an ideal world, we would like that to be the case, but it doesn't mean, if members of certain groups or members of the public can't do that, it doesn't mean that that information is not useful to them, or that they don't act in a way which makes that information useful. So I guess it's trying not to strive for that perfect world, which would be very hard to reach, is very impractical, really.
And I think when we think about how we make decisions in our own lives in areas where we're not the experts, we can relate to that. If you go to the doctor, you don't want, you know, then to know that there's a 57.2856 chance that you're going to have this kind of cancer that's going to mean this. You want to know something more general on what should you do, what are the risks, and so on. Or if you think about when you're driving towards an intersection and there's a traffic light that's going to change, you don't calculate in your mind like the distance to the traffic light and how soon it's going to turn red and the likelihood of a car coming the other direction. You just make a decision based on kind of your perception of the situation and how fast you're going and how fast you want to get somewhere and so on. So when we make decisions in our own lives, we're often taking this complex, what could be really complex analytical information, and making simplified decisions. And that's what other people are doing in areas where they're not the experts.
And the aim of yesterday's meeting was to stimulate the discussion. And that's, you know, clearly happened both yesterday, and I think that will continue. But also to pull together a community of people who are working in this area, and I think that was important for you, Andrew. So if anybody picks up on the podcast and wants to kind of get in touch or to find out more or to get involved in that discussion, how would you get them to do that?
You can contact me on Twitter, so I'm at Charlton Perez on Twitter, or you can look me up on the University of Reading website and send me an email. And I'd really welcome people who are interested. Both, I think what was nice as well yesterday is we had a lot of people from the practitioner community, and I'd really welcome people who are, you know, doing this for a living. I have the nice position where I can think about it, but I never have to do it in reality. So if there are people who have to do it in reality and they want to talk to me about that, then please do. And anyone else who's, you know, both in the field of meteorology, but also in all those other fields, you know, psychology or health or other fields, and they want to get in touch with me, and yeah, let's try and build a community around this in the UK. I think there's a real opportunity here for us to do that.
Great. So thank you both for yesterday, but also for joining in the podcast this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So that went pretty well for our first interview.
Yeah, I thought that was really good, actually. Nice, relaxed, lots of information really from Andrew and Rebecca about their own personal views on this, but also how the meeting went and content. And I would just encourage people, if you're interested in finding out more, you can go to our website. The PowerPoint presentations are available to view online, and the audio from the meeting as well is there. So you can dip in, or you can listen to the whole meeting again if you want.
Yes, and you can look at the Facebook Live things just to see exactly what kind of issues I had. But yeah, overall, the meeting was a success. And I guess that would be a good point to jump into what our upcoming meetings are.
Yeah, so if we just start with the national meetings, we've got one in October. So that's on Wednesday, the 18th of October at UCL, University College in London. And that's entitled Meltdown, the Abrupt Climate Change Since the Last Ice Age. So a really interesting meeting looking at climate a long time ago, so at the end of the last ice age when we saw a significant change in our climate, and maybe what we can learn from that in the current state of our changing climate as well. So that's the October meeting. In November, on the 15th of November at Trinity House, again in London, we've got one on maritime meteorology, again looking at various things from people who sail for leisure or for their own professional activities. So it really looks at the kind of weather information that's available, whether you're just an amateur sailor or you're basically going off around the world on large container ships, for example. So that'll be a really interesting meeting. I think the other one I want to mention as well is our conference in November. So that's on the 4th of November up in London at Westminster Hall. And that's Weather Live. Yeah, absolutely. So that's called Weather Live, and it's basically split into three topics this year. So we're going to look a little bit at weather and photography. We have our Weather Photographer of the Year, which we announced the winners at last week as well, at the same event we've just been listening to the podcast.
Some awesome images.
Yeah, fantastic images. And we'll talk about weather photography. It's a bit of history of weather photography, but also how to give some tips for people who want to improve their weather photography. And also this year, it's the 30th anniversary of the 1987 storm. And most people remember Mike Fish going on the TV on that infamous day back in October 1987, saying he'd had a telephone call from a lady saying there's a hurricane on the way. And lo and behold, we had this huge storm come through and the devastation, particularly across southern England. So we're going to take a look back at what happened, both in images, but also Mike Fish is coming along to talk about his own kind of personal experience of that whole event and what we've learned from that event and how we've move forward in forecasting. And then the other area of Weather Live is looking at weather and gardening. So we're working with the Royal Horticultural Society at the moment, and they have just issued a report earlier this year on gardening in a changing climate. So the focus of that session will be really looking at how we as gardeners can adapt and change the way that we grow and sustain our gardens for the future. So there'll be a little bit of conversation around that. We've got Peter Gibbs along, so people may be familiar. Peter is a TV weather presenter, but he also does Gardeners Question Time on the radio. So he'll be overlapping into both his weather and his gardening.
Great. Something for everyone.
Yeah.
I guess one of the reasons I said at the beginning why we're doing this podcast is that we want to engage with people. And so I urge people to feedback on this and bear in mind that it is our first. So please be kind, be gentle. usual addresses. So our website address is www.rmets.org, rmets.org. Facebook, we are Royal Metsoc, or just do a search for Royal Meteorological Society and you'll get us. And on Twitter, we are at rmets. So yeah, please, it'd be good to hear from you. And if you have any suggestions as to what we should call this podcast, nice ones, that would be great. So it'd be good to hear from you. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be with you again soon.
Thank you.